This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Karen Reed.
She screamed, "Stop! There he is!" And just like that, the quiet dread that had been brewing all night turned into full-blown horror. That's how Jennifer McCabe described the moment Karen Reed allegedly spotted John O'Keefe's body in the snow outside 34 Fairview Road. Through whiteout conditions where you really couldn't see that far into the yard, that line, "There he is," didn't come after minutes of searching. It came the second their car pulled up. Headlights sweeping across the front yard, according to McCabe, Reed saw him immediately lying there, lifeless in the dark, in the snow, and then threw herself out of the car to get him. The only problem with that is he was completely covered in snow and no one could see him there. This is day 6 of the trial of Karen Reed. I'm Tony Bruschi. Thank you for joining us. In the comments section, if you're watching us on YouTube, please play along and give us your thoughts on how the case is reading to you. Good, bad, but give us some thought into to how you're feeling about everything right now. And we can certainly disagree. And that's totally fine. That's why I'm so interested to hear, okay, if you feel this way, why? Like, what's behind that? Because when we can understand that in each other, we can understand a lot more. You're not just, yeah. Anyway, please, in the comments section, let us know what your thoughts are about this. And if you're listening to us wherever you are on the podcast platforms, thank you so much. Be sure to press subscribe there and do check out our YouTube channel where you can watch us do all of this as well. And it's other, you know, YouTube kind of exclusive stuff over there as well. And if you're on YouTube, yeah, please press subscribe. Continuing on. That one moment, the instant recognition, the urgency, the sheer panic is what prosecutors zeroed in on as they walked the jury through McCabe's testimony on April 29th. Because if Karen Reed truly didn't know where John was, how could she possibly spot his body in seconds? Why are you freaking out in a hysterical way when you're calling Jen and Carrie? You went home thinking he's sleeping with somebody else. So when you wake up later, why is that now changed to, did I hit him? Could I have hit him? When we don't even know that he's on the ground yet. But she does have a cracked taillight that she notes. She also interjects, just for good measure, you know, a girl he dated before me lives over there. I wonder if he's sleeping with her. There's another one down there from a long time ago, too. I wonder if he's, because he'd be sleeping with her. But then very quickly reverts back to, we have to go to 34 Fairview. Even after Jen McCabe suggests, well, maybe check, his buddy's house over here. He's gone over there before. He's, you know, maybe he's on his couch. The logical thought at this point is not that he's dead in someone's yard, unless you somehow know he's dead in someone's yard. Consciously or not consciously, that's in Karen's mind. Before they get to the house, before they find his body, this is what's going through her mind. It's not he's sleeping with another woman, although it does enter for a moment. It's not always, you know, he's on a buddy's couch. It's not, you know, is he at the Elbert house passed out somewhere? It's, did I hit him? And you know precisely where to go before anybody found him. Why wouldn't you be going to the front door? Because look, you couldn't see his body. It was whiteout conditions. A lot of snow has fallen. And if you have something, you know, yay big on the ground, like this, like I'm holding up a Stanley, you know, like flat, that gets covered. You're not going to see it. Those are where you lose shovels and all sorts of things in your yard when it snows and it doesn't go away for 5 months. Oh yeah, I forgot about that. I'm surprised they didn't see it in there. Just don't see it. It's not like little patches of snow here and it's just, you know, dustings on the ground. This is inches and inches and inches of snow. It's called a nor'easter. You don't really want to be in one. I mean, unless you're like at a bar. Anyway, which is what they were all doing that night in a very jovial mood as well. So why not be checking the back of the house or knock on the door, walk the yard? McCabe says Reed knew exactly where to look. And that's the part that stuck with people. It's kind of a thing that either points to guilt or, if you're in the defense camp, trauma-fueled intuition. But we're not here to assume. We're here to walk through exactly what was said under oath, what it looked like in that courtroom, and why the state believes this was the moment that cracks everything. So let's rewind the tape to just before that scream. And Jennifer McCabe took the stand as the prosecution's key civilian witness, a longtime friend of both Karen Reed and John O'Keefe, specifically longer with O'Keefe. Her testimony focused on the early hours of January 29th, 2022, when a night of drinks and what should have been harmless socializing turned into a death investigation. According to McCabe, sometime just before 5 a.m., her phone rang. It was someone from John O'Keefe's family, his niece. And if we're following the trail, and in the background, McCabe could hear Karen Reed screaming, not crying, screaming, hysterical. McCabe testified that she could barely understand what Reed was saying, but she made out enough. O'Keefe hadn't come home, and she thought she might have left him at the bar they'd all gone to the night before, the waterfall. McCabe said Reed was frantically bouncing around in thought, trying to make sense of things. But then came something that the prosecution hammered. McCabe claims Reed suddenly started asking, "Did I hit him? Could I have hit him?" Over and over. Not where is he, not could he have gone inside, but did I hit him? It's a question that is either a genuine fear or an accidental confession or something in the middle, depending on which side of the courtroom you're sitting on. Then Reed allegedly mentioned her taillight was broken, something she said she didn't notice until that morning. McCabe said this too came out of that same breathless panic, the kind where thoughts come flying out faster then your mouth can filter them. At face value, it might sound like an innocent observation, but in the context of a possible hit and run, it's the kind of detail prosecutors don't just appreciate, they highlight in red and circle twice. At this point, McCabe didn't hang up. She got moving. She called another friend, Carrie Roberts, and the three women coordinated to meet up and start looking for John O'Keefe. McCabe testified that the first stop was O'Keefe's own house, but then Reed absolutely insisted that they go to 34 Fairview Road instead. This was the home of Brian and Nicole Elbert, McCabe's sister and brother-in-law, and the location where they'd all gone after leaving the bar the night before. This is where the party was. So now you got McCabe in the front passenger seat, Roberts driving, Reed in the back. It's dark, it's snowy, and no one's had any sleep. Or very, very little. According to McCabe, as soon as the car approached Fairview, Reed practically lunged forward towards the window, pointed in the yard, and shouted, "There he is." That's when the brakes hit and everything changed. It was whiteout conditions. You couldn't see into the yard. But she knew that's where he was. Was it by seeing him? Or was it because she knew that's where he was? That's where you can get to second-degree murder. Leaving the body. Leaving an accident. But you also have to prove that the person even knew there was an accident. I can see where that could come into play, and I don't know you can prove that. Because if that's what's going on, she just backed up, wanted to say one more thing, or who knows? She was drunk. Maybe she just had it in the wrong gear. Whether she shouted anything out the window at John, I don't know. That's conjecture. But I could see that sort of thing happening. And then maybe looking around and not seeing him, going, where the hell is that asshole? Or something like that in your mind. And then you take off. Not another thought of, could I have hit him? But just, that was weird. Maybe he got into the house already. Or whatever's running through your mind. But what one thing is not running through your mind is, did I just hit him? Until the next morning, and you have a broken taillight, and you put together the piece that is kind of weird that you didn't see him when you looked back. Oh, shit. Little chunk of memory there. McCabe says they all jumped out of the car. Roberts ran ahead. McCabe says she couldn't see anything at first, just snow falling. But then saw Carrie kneeling over someone, and it was John. He was lying in the yard, not far from a flagpole, his body partially covered by snow. Reed was already by his side, allegedly straddling him and screaming as if trying to wake him up. According to McCabe, it was like she had lost control of her body. She was overtaken, it seemed, by the way that it was described. Now, pause here, because this part is important. In court, McCabe started to cry. This wasn't a performative wipe the eyes sort of thing either. Multiple reporters noted she was visibly shaking. She was struggling to speak. And when the prosecutor asked her what she was feeling in that moment, she said she was frozen, in shock. She kept repeating that it didn't look real, that the man lying in the snow didn't even look like John at first. He looked like a statue, frozen stiff. She also said that Carrie, in that same moment, Carrie Roberts eventually yelled at Reed to get off him, not because she was doing anything wrong, but because it was chaotic and desperate, and that wasn't how you were going to try and save him, basically. McCabe ran to her car to get blankets and towels, anything to help. She called 911. She tried chest compressions. The scene was described as frantic, emotional, and confusing, exactly the kind of moment prosecutors want jurors to sit with. Because here's the thing. The prosecution isn't just using McCabe to tell a story. They're using her to frame one, to lay down a version of events that places Karen Reed not just at the scene, but already consumed with guilt before anyone else even knew there was a body in the yard. They want the jurors to remember how quickly Reed saw him, how she allegedly didn't question where to look, how she went from "I don't know where he is" to "there he is" with no hesitation. And more importantly, they're pointing to the timeline. McCabe's call with Reed was just before 5 a.m. The 911 call came shortly after, but the prosecution says everything leading up to that call, the night at the bar, the drive to Fairview, the SUV parked out front, it all happened well before 1:30 a.m. So that's nearly a four-hour window where Reed, according to the state, knew something terrible had happened and didn't call for help. That gap is what they're trying to get jurors to focus on. To be clear, McCabe isn't a neutral party. She's friends with the Alberts. She's related to Nicole. That's been noted more than once. And yes, the defense has made it known that they believe the entire narrative is part of a broader attempt to cover for someone else, someone inside the house. But McCabe's testimony on, well, the 29th didn't delve into any of that. This wasn't about theories or third parties. This was about a mourning, about what she saw, about how it all unfolded. Bunch of friends getting together, very jovial night. Cameras captured that. Not to mention the testimony of every single person who was there. They're all in on the conspiracy, all to get Karen. not grandiose thinking at all, Karen, that all these people will be out to get you. But I do disagree with the charge. I don't think it should have ever been second degree. I just don't know that you have, and that you can prove that she knew that she did anything to him other than putting the pieces together in the morning and going, oh shit. I could see that, or a fleeting memory, like I said before, hitting reverse, looking back, not seeing John. That's weird. He just got out. Fuck it. I'm going home. The vehicle data will tell us more about how long she was out there, which, you know, might be relevant, might not be. But I think there'll be interesting pieces to learn about where she was and at what point and for how long. Anyway, Kerry Roberts expected a return for cross-examination, which is when the defense will almost certainly try to chip away at her credibility. But for now, jurors had a powerful first impression, a tearful witness recounting the discovery of her frozen friend's body and the girlfriend who may have known all along where he was. And that right there is where the state's case starts to take an emotional shape. It's not just about science or timelines or broken taillights. It's about what people said, what they did, and how they reacted when it all came crashing down. Now we move away from the emotional chaos of that moment into the cold, calculated world of digital forensics, because while McCabe gave us the human story today, the phone might hold the one that can't lie. It's often said that phones know more about us than we do. They track our movements, catalog our routines, and record every late-night call we thought no one noticed. And on day six of the Karen Reed trial, that was the entire point. Prosecutors brought in digital forensic expert Ian Whiffen to do what phones do best, tell a story that doesn't rely on memory, emotion, or human error, just data. Cold, time-stamped, unblinking data. Whiffen, a digital intelligence analyst with Cellebrite, was tasked with dissecting the activity on John O'Keefe's iPhone for the night of January 28th into the early hours of January 29th, 2022. His job wasn't to guess what happened. It was to show frame by frame where that phone was, when it moved, who it communicated with, what it was feeling deep down inside, and how long it stayed in a single place. That's important in this story. And what they found became a technical battleground between the prosecution's version of the night and the defense's alternative story. So let's start with the basics. According to Whiffen, John O'Keefe's phone was active at 12:29 a.m. Picked up a call from Jennifer McCabe. Shortly after that, Karen Reed called him twice, once at 12:33 a.m. and again at 12:34 a.m., and he didn't answer either one. Those timestamps are significant. They suggest that between 12:29 and 12:34, something changed. Either he stepped out of the car, lost consciousness, or was no longer in a position to answer. Whatever happened, the phone went dark in terms of communication. But what didn't go dark was its movement. Whiffen testified that around 12:32 a.m., the iPhone registered 36 steps, about 84 feet in total. Not a jog, not a flight of stairs, just enough to walk across a yard or up a driveway. The data point was pulled from the app's health app, which logs steps actively based on motion sensors. And according to Whiffen, it suggested O'Keefe moved a short distance around that time. But the direction, the pattern, was it a straight walk? Was it pacing? That, Whiffen clarified, couldn't be determined from the data alone. That brings us to the phone's location using GPS logs and sensor data. Whiffen tracked the phone's position from 12:24 a.m. onward. He said the GPS clusters, the dense pockets of location pings, were all centered around the front yard of 34 Fairview Road, right around where O'Keefe's body was eventually found. The implication was clear. According to the data, the phone never entered the house. It stayed out front in the same general vicinity for hours. He had a nice little map, too, that showed basically the dots all being in pretty much the same general area by the flagpole. Prosecutors leaned on that hard. If the phone never went inside, then maybe John O'Keefe didn't either. And if he didn't go inside, then the theory that something happened to him indoors, the third-party assault, the house party gone wrong, loses its foundation. From the state's perspective, that GPS data backs up their timeline. He got out of the SUV, didn't go in the house, remained in the yard until he died. But the defense wasn't going to, you know, just let that rest. And they did not. And they were not going to stand unchallenged. During cross-examination, defense attorney Robert Alessi pulled up one of Whiffen's own reports, a location map showing GPS accuracy ranges instead of tight pinholes. The data showed circles. Circles, Jerry! When expanded to reflect margin of error, it included not just the yard, but portions of the house itself. You know, like the corner areas where it's not the whole house, it's a circle. It's just a longer circle, technically. But the center of that circle is what's important. Unless he oppressed him. Could the phone have been inside the house at some point? Not definitively, but possibly. Whiffen's answer was careful. Yes, he said, based on those low-accuracy GPS points, it was technically possible that the phone, and by extension, O'Keefe, was inside the house at some point. He didn't say it happened. He didn't say it was likely, but the door wasn't completely closed. And that's all the defense needed. They weren't asking the jury to believe a whole new story just yet. They were planting the idea that the state's version might not be airtight. Next came the battery data. Whiffen pulled temperature logs from the iPhone's battery sensors. And here's what they found. At 12:24 a.m., the battery registered around 80 degrees Fahrenheit, normal for a phone that's been in a warm car or a coat pocket. But by 6 a.m., it dropped to 37 degrees. Slow, steady decline, aligned with a phone being left outside in freezing conditions. And to test this, Whiffen even ran his own experiments. He placed phones in similar temperatures, one in a freezer, one outside overnight, and compared how fast they cooled. His conclusion? The curve on O'Keefe's phone matched what he'd expect from a device left out in the cold. Again, the implication was that O'Keefe and his phone had been outside all night. And again, the defense came swinging. Alessi pointed out that Whiffen's freezer test showed a much steeper temperature drop, about 50 degrees, Mr. Watson, in just 15 minutes. Why was O'Keefe's phone cooling so slowly in a snowstorm? Whiffen explained that outdoor conditions vary. A freezer is constant. A snowy night has wind, moisture, and even body heat to consider. Alessi pounced on that last part. Body heat? Was he suggesting someone was lying on top of the phone? Whiffen didn't take the bait. He simply acknowledged that insulating factors like clothing or a person's body, because, you know, I don't know how long John was still, you know, alive. Probably took a little while. Could affect the rate of cooling. That line drew an objection, but it was already in the air. And it's true. So we're left with data that mostly supports the prosecution's case, but not without question marks. The GPS shows the phone outside, but not with surgical precision. The step count shows movement, but not the direction. The battery cooling suggests exposure, but maybe not a complete exposure. And all of that opens the door just a crack for the defense to argue that something else could have happened in those early morning hours. And yeah, you're going for reasonable doubt. One of the more overlooked but critical parts of Whiffen's testimony was how thoroughly he debunked any suggestion that the phone data had been tampered with. The defense floated the idea that the software discrepancies, differences between Cellbrite and another forensic tool called Magnet, made by a completely different company, might mean something was off. Specifically, they focus on a Google search from Jennifer McCabe's phone, the timing of which we'll go into in just a moment. But when it came to O'Keefe's phone, Whiffen was adamant the high values, essentially the phone's digital fingerprint, had not changed. There was no signals of data manipulation. And if someone had altered the evidence, Whiffen said, they would have to do it flawlessly, not just once, but across multiple data points, across multiple tools, without triggering a single inconsistency. He told the jury that, in his professional opinion, the data was intact, untouched, and trustworthy. Do you think that PD can... I mean, come on. Do you think they'd have the... Do you think they'd be able to pull that one off? No, I don't either. Still, the defense got what they needed, the admission that the data isn't perfect and that the story it tells might have more than one interpretation. Whether that's enough to move the jury is another question, but in terms of strategy, the seeds of doubt were planted. All of this, the calls, the steps, the location points, and the battery curve make up the digital spine of the prosecution's case. It's how they frame the timeline, isolate the moment of separation between Reed and O'Keefe, and argue that he was never let inside. But as we saw today, even a forensic timeline can bend, if not break, under the weight of technical scrutiny. What came next in the courtroom wasn't just about where the phones were, but who was using them, and more importantly, when. Because there's a Google search, one very specific morbid query that's become a flashpoint in this case, and its timestamp could change everything. There's something uniquely disturbing about seeing a Google search become the centerpiece of a murder trial, but that's exactly what has happened in the court as the focus shifted to a six-word query that's been replayed, dissected, and fought over more than some entire witnesses' testimonies. The phrase, how's long to die in the cold? Not that cold. I just naturally said that. How's long to die in cold? And the question isn't just what it says, it's what when it was typed. Because that single timestamp might be the difference between a desperate attempt to understand what happened and the suggestion that someone knew something long before they should have and did nothing about it. And that's where we get into our next area. On the stand is the digital forensic analyst Ian Whiffen again. Same expert, but this time instead of tracking steps and phone locations, he's walking the jury through a full-blown tech tutorial. His goal? To explain why Jennifer McCabe's Google search didn't necessarily happen at 2:27 a.m., even though that timestamp keeps popping up in the data. It's a bit like being in a murder trial and a tech support call at the same time. But it's just, this isn't just about, you know, quirks in a browser. It's about credibility, timeline, and motive. So here's what Whiffen lays out. According to his analysis using Cellebrite, one of the leading forensic tools in the world, McCabe opened an internet tab at 2:27 a.m. But the actual search, the part where she typed in how's long to die in cold, didn't happen until 6:23 a.m. after John O'Keefe's body was found. The confusion, he says, sometimes, this is trying to make it as simple as we can, sometimes it comes from how certain forensic tools track last visited timestamps. Just because a tab was opened at 2:27 doesn't mean anything was typed in at that time. A timestamp only marks when the tab was activated, not what was done with it. To prove it, Whiffen did a live demonstration in court. He opened a browser tab on a device, let it sit there. Later, he typed something in that search bar. When he went back and looked at the data, the software still logged the last visited time as when he opened the tab. There you go. Everybody got the show. Not when he entered the search. That's the moment you could feel the temperature in the courtroom drop. Because if Whiffen is right, the narrative that McCabe somehow searched about freezing to die before they found the body, it kind of starts to unravel. Because it makes no sense. Yeah, and she's searching for basketball scores at the same time. That seems like her. Be quite a personality switch, now wouldn't it? The defense wasn't ready to let her or let go of that thread, though. Attorney Robert Alessi brought receipts, figuratively and literally. He pointed out that the original forensic report before Cellbrite software was updated showed the search as happening at 2:27 a.m. Sure, and that's not just some minor detail. If McCabe searched for information about dying in the cold at that hour, it would have been before anyone claimed to know John was outside, before the 911 call, and before they allegedly found his body. That would imply prior knowledge, the kind you don't have unless you saw something or did something hours before the discovery. So Alessi went after the tech itself. He asked why Cellbrite updated their software to stop showing the 2:27 timestamp. Was it to correct a bug or to make inconvenient data disappear? Whiffen's answer was blunt. The timestamp was removed because it was misleading. Too many people were interpreting tab opened as search made. The software change was about clarity, not concealment. Still, unless he leaned in. What about other tools? He asked. He pointed to Magnet Forensics, rather, a compelling digital analysis program that still shows the 2:27 time next to the search. Is Cellbrite out of step, or is Magnet the one showing the real data? Whiffen didn't budge. He acknowledged the discrepancy, but he stood his ground. The search, he insisted, was executed at 6:23 a.m. All the forensic metadata support that. He even pointed to the hash values, unique data signatures that verify file integrity. If someone had manipulated the data to cover something up, those hashes would be off. They weren't. Every one of them lined up. Facts. But if you don't want to believe it, you don't have to. He must be in on the conspiracy too. Whiffen added that any forensic analyst trying to doctor the timeline would have to alter multiple logs across multiple systems and somehow avoid triggering any red flags. He called that scenario not just unethical, but virtually impossible without getting caught. It would be like rewriting the timestamp on every copy of a surveillance tape and then syncing them all back up perfectly across different cameras and formats. The bottom line, the data held up under scrutiny, even if it didn't tell the cleanest story. That didn't stop the defense from trying to make it even messier. The suggestion wasn't just that the timestamp might be wrong, but that someone might be selectively highlighting or hiding things. Unless he never accused Whiffen directly, he didn't need to. He simply laid the breadcrumbs and let the jury imagine what might be at the end of the trail. Look at that jury. Breadcrumbs. In front of the man with the accent. What could that mean? Now, while all of this was happening on the tech front, another kind of drama was brewing in the courtroom, and this one had nothing to do with search engines. Late in the day, after the jury had left, Judge Beverly Cannone called both sides up for a tea party. They sat there, they had tea and little cakes, little sandwiches. No, they didn't. For a heated discussion about the defense's expert witnesses, specifically two crash reconstructionists, Dr. Daniel Wolf and Dr. Andrew Rechler from a firm called ARCA. You may remember these guys. These are the guys from the defense, and they're counting on to argue that O'Keefe's injuries don't match being hit by Karen Reed's SUV. In other words, their testimony is critical to the third-party theory that someone inside the house harmed John and that he wasn't hit by a car after all. The problem, according to prosecutors, the defense had been sitting on updated reports, newly performed tests, and even internal text messages relating to those experts' findings, all of which they allegedly failed to turn over in time. Special Prosecutor Hank Brennan wasn't subtle. He accused the defense of springing an ambush, violating discovery rules, and trying to smuggle in last-minute evidence without letting the state respond to it. And let's be honest, it wasn't a great look for the defense. Not a lot has been. Judge Cannone acknowledged as much. She called out what she described as repeated violations of court orders and was clearly frustrated. But in the end, she still ruled in the defense's favor. The experts will be allowed to testify, full stop. Her reasoning? Despite the shadiness around timing and disclosures, the defendant's right to present a full defense outweighs procedural sloppiness. Or as she put it, a defendant's right to a fair trial is paramount to everything. That didn't mean she was happy about it. Before wrapping up, she fired off a warning that hit with more force than any objection all day. No more nonsense. Let's just try this case. Kind of hung in the air. Sends mixed messages. On one hand, the defense gets what it wants, two credentialed experts who will likely offer testimony that challenges the prosecution's reconstruction. On the other, the judge made it clear that any more rule bending could land them in serious trouble. And that could have been a big issue on appeals. It's a tightrope act now, and the defense knows it. What this all means going forward is that the digital evidence, while powerful, is not beyond challenge. The defense had their opening. They've highlighted software conflicts, forced concessions on possible alternate interpretations, and secured the right to bring in their own narrative about what happened physically at the crime scene. And while the prosecution may have walked away from the day with their Google search controversy largely diffused, the defense still managed to inject just enough doubt to keep their theory alive. What happens next is anyone's guess. I want to be like Job from Arrested Development, just a bunch of pennies. Voila! What'd you guys think about the day in court? Tell us in the comment section. We would love to hear it. Press subscribe wherever you are listening to us or watching us. If you're just listening, please check out our YouTube channel. You can watch us over there and join in the conversations. It's such a cliche thing to say, join in the conversation, but I don't know any other way to say it. You know, you can join in the conversation. So please do all of that. And, you know, share us. Let your friends know that we exist. We'd really very much appreciate that. And welcome to all of our new subscribers, because we are getting tons of them every single day. And I'm kind of blown away. So thank you guys for that. We're going to keep putting out our stuff and hope you guys always enjoy. My name is Tony Brewski, and we will talk again. I'm going to say very, very soon.
If true crime is your obsession, we've got you covered. Press subscribe now to the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today for nonstop coverage, expert insights, and in-depth analysis. The Smiths thought they found the perfect babysitter. Sweet, responsible, a glowing recommendation from the neighbors. She had a way with kids, calm, patient, always smiling. But what the Smiths didn't know was that their perfect babysitter had been using that same glowing reputation to slip in and out of homes for years, quietly collecting little trophies from every house she entered. Bracelets, photos, sometimes something even more disturbing. If only they had known. If only they had heard the exact type of case like this, broken down on Hidden Killers with Tony Brewski. If they had only subscribed to True Crime Today, Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts, they could have listened ad-free before everyone else and caught on to the signs before it was too late. Instead, let's just say they're in desperate need of a new babysitter and some therapy. Subscribe now to True Crime Today, Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts.